The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week, we hear from a leading figure in genomic research.
I get that question. So what have you done for us lately? It's been 2 years since you created life.
Craig Venter talks to Science Weekly after his keynote address at this year's Euroscience Open Forum, which took place recently in Dublin. And, cue cheesy sound effect of a door opening. Yes, open science is back in the news as the European Commission chimes with the UK government in calling for all government-funded research to be free to access and download by 2014. Joining me to discuss this will be Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Craig Venter is one of the world's leading biologists. He's made numerous invaluable contributions to genomic research, and he's a pioneer in the emerging field of synthetic biology. In May 2010, he made headlines around the world after creating what he called the world's first synthetic life form. He put together an artificial chromosome and inserted it into a single-celled bacterium. Venter was a good choice then as the man to update a very influential lecture in the history of biology. In 1943, the physicist Erwin Schrödinger spoke in Dublin in a series of talks called What is Life? These were published a year later in a book and focused on one important question. How can the events in space and time, which take place within the spatial boundary of a living organism, be accounted for by physics and chemistry? Schrödinger's lecture inspired James Watson and Francis Crick in their work on discovering the double helix structure of DNA. In turn, that kick-started the field of molecular biology. Craig Venter went to Dublin recently to update Schrödinger's lecture in a talk titled What is Life? A 21st Century Perspective. I spoke to him after he delivered his talk, and in this extract of our conversation, I asked Venter to sum up what we know now that Erwin Schrödinger did not know when he wrote What is Life?
Well, the year his book was published is when Avery published his paper showing that DNA was actually the genetic material. We learned a few years later that proteins are comprised of linear amino acid chains. Then in 53, obviously, Watson Crick showing the basic alpha helical structure of DNA and how that could be self-replicated. So a summation of what we know is we know the linear genetic code codes for a linear protein code. That linear protein code determines how fast a protein folds, what it folds into, and what its function is, and how fast it gets degraded. So all the components of the hardware of the cell are controlled directly by the genetic code. And if you change the genetic code, you can change whether a protein works, what it does, how fast it folds, whether it gets degraded quickly. So all the things that regulate the cell now are 100% traceable to the linear genetic code. And we prove that by synthesizing the genome, putting it into a cell and having a cell that every molecule in the cell derived from that linear code. So the circle's been completely closed with our work 2 years ago.
Now, in the 70 years since that lecture, as you said, all these discoveries have led to the development of molecular biology, which is one of the most exciting fields in science at the moment, and it's a field that you're leading. You mentioned the work you did 2 years ago. Now, that was to create a synthetic genome and put it into an existing cell. Introduce for us what that proved, because it was the first time someone had done that.
So it proved, in fact, that DNA, as I describe it, is the software of life. So putting that new DNA into a cell, it completely converted one species into another. So the new cell that derived from the synthetic DNA had not one single molecule of the original cell. Everything in that cell came from the synthetic chromosome we put in the cell. So it really proves unconditionally that DNA is the software of life. and that everything in the cell derives from the genetic code. A lot of people wanted to think that the cell itself was the most important thing, and there's researchers in labs in different parts of the world, Italy, others trying to make what they call artificial cells just by putting proteins in lipid vesicles. Obviously, now that just seems silly, because without the genetic code to create the new proteins that die within seconds to minutes, you can't have life. In fact, if you want to kill a cell, you take out its DNA.
So the discovery you just talked about was published in the journal Science in May 2010. We're just over 2 years later. What have you been doing since then?
I get that question. So what have you done for us lately? It's been 2 years since you created life. Look, I had teams of about 400 scientists and staff, both at the our not-for-profit Basic Research Institute, the Venture Institute, and also at Synthetic Genomics. And you know, the teams are working diligently in numerous areas, but in the synthetic genomic area, we're trying to design the first other species totally designed in the computer. And we're in the process of now synthesizing the chromosome to see if our design works. So once we make the DNA, we'll transplant it into a cell like we did 2 years ago and see if it results in a new life form.
So the interesting thing is that the difference there is the publication 2 years ago was recreating something that already existed in nature. Now you want to create something that doesn't exist in nature.
Well, what we did 2 years ago was something that doesn't exist in nature, but it was about 90% based on a living cell. And the point was, it took us 15 years to get to that point to prove that proof of concept actually worked.
So
if you ask most scientists, they would have predicted that experiment wouldn't have worked, or transplanting a genome and getting a new cell, just because even though it's been about 60 some odd years since Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, there's still a lot of people sort of clinging to the notions that existed when Schrodinger gave his lecture, that you know somehow there's magical powers associated with proteins or the cells. And you know, reductionist science has now broken things down, as Schrodinger wanted to do, to the basic components that we really understand the molecules of life. You know, creating a new species that never existed before seems actually a trite thing to me. The experiment we did as the proof of concept is the one that will change everything going forward. So whether it's a new species or not is really irrelevant. We actually wanted to have something that we knew would have a chance of working with all the millions of odds against it working in the first place. So, but we are trying to see if we can design. The goal is not just to design a new species. We're trying to get down to a minimal cell to understand the minimal molecular components of life.
So the species, the life forms you're designing in the computer, or rather your teams are designing, tell us a bit about those. What kinds of things are you engineering them to do, and how close are you to actually making them living?
Well, we're trying to engineer them to live. Nobody knows all the absolute components to make a minimal living cell. What are the sets of genes that are absolutely essential for life? And the reason we don't know that, scientists can't get money from governments or funding agencies to actually study the unknown. So even in the minimal cell, there's about 100 genes. The only thing we know about them is if you take them out, the cell dies. We don't know what their function is yet. So it tells you about the state of modern science. Even the tiniest cell on the planet, about a quarter of the genes are of unknown function. So when you jump to the human genome, we probably know less than half of the genes and what they actually do.
And so in your experiments then, to create a minimal life form, how do you know whether when you knock something out or take away a gene that it's not that it's actually something that's very functional and necessary, rather than it's something that is just required for that particular environment?
Well, so that's what we talked about a little bit yesterday. Life is conditional. And so there's no such thing as the minimal cell. All life is environmentally relevant. So if there's not oxygen in the environment, we as a species wouldn't do too well for very long. These minimal cells have to have the media that they grow in contain sugars for them to grow on. And they have to be specific sugars, so we have the right transport molecules in the membrane to transport those sugars in. Instead of manufacturing their own amino acids, they get it all by feeding on what's in the environment. So if the environment didn't have sugar or amino acids for food, things that we get by eating sugar, fruit, meat, these cells would not survive. So I also talked last night about Methanococcus eunacea. It's the first archaea that we sequenced in 1996. It's an autotroph. It makes everything from inorganic constituents. So its carbon source is CO2. Its energy source is hydrogen. So everything is very much contextually dependent on the environment where it lives.
Now, what does a synthetic life form look like? If you ask someone to imagine one, they might just think it looks like a normal life form, a cell perhaps, with a synthetic chromosome, and it multiplies and it's been programmed to do something specific. But do you need all of the bits of a cell? Do you need to create everything? What kinds of life forms do you envisage when this technology really gets going?
So we're trying to design at Synthetic Genomics, the company, new cells to accomplish specific tasks, either making new kinds of food molecules. We're trying to create energy from carbon dioxide and photosynthesis. So the notion is that life is a DNA software-driven system. And so we don't have to design all the components in the cell. We just have to write the new software, and the cell makes everything based on what that software tells it to do. I mean, it may sound like an oversimplification of how life works, but at the fundamental levels, it works remarkably simply, the same way your computer or iPhone works. There's a set of instructions on the DNA. Those instructions build all the protein components. The proteins are the functional parts. Just one single protein makes up about 1/4 of everything in your body, and that's collagen. We have a range of proteins, so our hardware is proteins. And the instructions tell the cells which hardware to make. So it's at one level, I think Schrodinger would have loved it, that it's a pretty simple concept, very much along the lines of what he proposed in 1943.
To hear that interview in all its glory, go to the Guardian website where you can download it as a Science Weekly extra. If you subscribe via iTunes, by the way, then you actually don't need to do anything at all. It'll already be there in your feed. If you're not a subscriber, well, now's the time to sign up for free. Just look for us in the iTunes store under Science and Medicine Podcasts, or hit the subscribe button by going to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, to talk Higgs and open science, I'm joined by The Guardian's surfing czar and science correspondent, Ian Sample. Ian, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Alok.
It's been a while. Well, you had the Higgs special, but I wasn't there, so it doesn't count. So how was your time away?
It was fantastic. How would it not be? I was in the jungles of Costa Rica surfing every day for a month.
And were you pleased to have discovered the Higgs boson as soon as you came back?
Yeah, I should add I wasn't surfing in the jungles. I was surfing in the sea around the jungles. And I got back within a handful of days of what looks like the Higgs being discovered. So that was, I knew that this kind of thing was on the cards. So it was actually in my game plan to be back for the 4th of July.
Well, I was going to say, this is probably, so for someone like you who's written a book about it, massive, available in all good bookshops now, which probably needs an update, but we'll talk about that later. You came back the day before CERN announced this sort of cryptic sounding press conference. Now, CERN are good at this. Back in December last year, we did a live blog, special podcast. John Butterworth came in to discuss how you actually find signals in the LHC. I mean, really good, crunchy quantum mechanics stuff there. And the world was on edge, and it didn't quite happen. There was a sort of a signal. The two detectors there found some bumps, but it wasn't quite a discovery. So you could be forgiven for thinking that when they called another press conference on July the 4th, that perhaps this was another one of those physicists find, just get a bit closer, but not sure. Tell us why, what they discovered, and why it's a bit different to what happened in December.
Okay, so what they've discovered, first of all, the easy bit, is that it's not actually that clear. But this has been a search that has been finely tuned to look for a Higgs boson, so a particle that does the job of a Higgs boson. Okay.
Do we need to go through what a Higgs boson is for our listeners? I don't think so.
I doubt we need to go through all of that, but yeah. let's you know. So the Higgs boson, as predicted, the simplest version in the standard model, it breaks down. It doesn't hang around waiting to be measured. It immediately, as soon as it's created, disintegrates into other particles. And this search, the searches that both teams were doing, was tuned to look for a particular type. So if you then find a particle that decays the way you're looking for it, and it's around the sort of, has this kind of mass that you're expecting it, it behaves, you know, exactly like a Higgs particle. And people were saying, look, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck. But it's not entirely sure whether it's the simple version, a standard model Higgs, just a single one, or it could be one of a family of maybe five, or there's a small chance it's something extremely exotic that no one's ever really kind of thought of.
They found a signal for a brand new fundamental particle. That's the key part of this. And it's to the level of uncertainty and everything, which they can call a discovery rather than just an observation. So back in December, it was something like 2.8 sigma overall between all the measurements, which is counts as an observation in physics. But this is the dreamt of 5 sigma. They found something at 5 sigma, which means it's a claimed discovery. But as you say, you can't say definitively that it's a Higgs boson. It's just something. How are they going to find out whether it's a Higgs boson or not?
Well, what they're saying is that they found a Higgs. They're not sure if they found the Higgs. And there's still some qualifier in that as well, because there is still, as I say, the remote chance it's something very odd that just behaves very much like a Higgs. But what they need to do next, and they're going to run on. Normally they would expect to stop running the LHC in October. They're going to run on for a few months longer and just try and get far more collisions before they switch off at the end of the year. It will actually be the early next year now, because they're going to close down for a couple of years for just a lot of necessary maintenance work to get the machine up to full power. Now, what they'll be doing with all that data is they need to look in exquisite detail for any slight discrepancies in the rate at which the Higgs particle, if it's that's what it is produced in the machines, in the detectors, when these protons collide inside it. So they need to look at the rates of production, and they also need to look at the where they'll get more data really is the rates of decay. So are the decays happening as expected? Do you get the right numbers that you would get predicted by the standard model, or are they slightly different? And if they're slightly different, it could mean that this isn't a standard model Higgs, that it's something more interesting.
The theoretical predictions give the Higgs particular properties, a particular spin, a particular charge, actually no charge at all, a particular mass. Well, actually the mass is something that you can't do by prediction, but this is what they've discovered in the actual experiments. And to definitively call it the Higgs that has been predicted, you have to test all these different things in the future. And that's the when you can actually find a proper discovery in that respect. Yeah. Now, what does this mean for Peter Higgs? You were there in Geneva when it was announced. Peter Higgs had been invited. Tell us what...
Not technically.
Well, okay. So he was there. So give us a bit of a story about how he got there and how he reacted to it. Because, I mean, scientists can sometimes be a bit sort of conservative about these things. Oh, well, we need more data. We'll see. What did Peter Higgs do?
Well, first of all, these scenes were bizarre, and I'm sure a lot of people listening will have watched this. And it was extraordinary to see this 83-year-old guy who's actually doing really well, considering, you know, he's an old guy. He's you know, he's very with it. He's very mobile, all the rest of it. Walk into the auditorium where these announcements are always made, and there is a huge round of applause for the guy. He sits down, the technical presentations play out. You have first up Joe Incandela from one of the detectors, CMS, then Fabiola Giannotti off Atlas. And at the end of, you know, both of these speakers were interrupted by applause when that magic Five Sigma or whatever figure goes up on their slides. They're drowned out. They have to stop their talks, wait for the applause to die down. When Fabiola finished, the second talk finished, the applause in the room, and this was beyond applause, it was cheers, it was whistles, it was just shouts almost. And Higgs, you know, was moved to tears. And there was this, you know, this infamous now, sorry, this famous shot now of him wiping the tears away. And I was talking to him about this, and he said it was just the sheer reaction of the crowd. He knew what was going to be said at that time, but the reaction of the audience, and just, you know, the culmination of what is more than 20 years' work for thousands of people, hits you all at once. And he said it was just overwhelming.
Well, he'd waited 50 years.
Yeah.
And he made his predictions in the 60s. And him and many other scientists, as he acknowledges, had made the predictions for the Higgs field, the Higgs mechanism, the Higgs boson. And so he's waited 50 years. I mean, it must be a great vindication for him.
Yeah, although I was asking him about this, and I was saying, you know, what is it like to come up with something in 64, and 48 years later, you see that thing you predicted, your baby, if you like, emerge from this international effort using this enormous machine.
Thousands of scientists, yeah. Billions of yeah. pounds.
And your baby emerges as basically a bump on a graph. What is that like? And I was actually expecting something very eloquent and lovely and quote-worthy. And he actually immediately did exactly what Peter Higgs would do and started referring to all the other people who have done work on this that he built on and all the people who have done work since his work in 64 to shore this up. And with each person he mentions, he kind of pushes himself further away from, you know, what he did himself. He kind of keeps this at arm's distance. And so He did think it was lovely, and I did think he found it just an enormous vindication, but he never doubted that it was there. He always was convinced it was there because he couldn't see how it could work otherwise. So, and there is this nice thing about Peter is that when he seems to make up his mind, he's pretty sure about things, and he doesn't. So I think he was just, well, of course it's there. So he didn't really have what you might imagine as a reaction of, yay, I'm right, you know. It was like, well, yeah.
Well, so what happens now at the LHC? You say it's going to carry on until the end of the year. It's only just got over half of its maximum power. I mean, it's at 8 tera-electron volts at the moment in terms of its collisions. It can get to 14. So it's got incredible discoveries ahead.
Yeah, we hope. And this is. I mean,
depending on what nature has actually in store. But yes.
Yeah, if you're a doom monger or perhaps a realist, you can say, this may be a Standard Model Higgs. It could also be the last thing we find in decades that's interesting in physics, unless there is something, you know, we can find, you know, some of the experiments come up with something else. Because if this is a Standard Model Higgs, it rounds off the Standard Model. Nowhere, no other great clues as
where'd you go then?
What else is going on? And that is the most pessimistic future, perhaps. But it's not. You can't dismiss it. But equally, you can say, look, this machine is only just really up to half of its potential, because even though it's been running at, like, you know, just over half power, it's only been running for a little while, just over half power. So sadly, it has to close down for 2 years for the work to be done to let it run at full power. And then it's going to come in. And that is that run then from 2015 onwards is the one to watch, because that run also will be one where it may take that run then to work out whether this is a simple Higgs or a more complex and interesting Higgs particle. We could have to wait till then.
We've got questions then beyond then about whether there are multiple dimensions out there, whether there's what dark matter perhaps is. I mean, these are the real questions the physicists want to answer from...
And also antimatter. Why are we matter antimatter not antimatter?
These are the real questions that they want to answer from this. The Higgs was just a sort of... I mean, I hesitate to say this, but a sort of a proof of concept that the LHC worked.
Well, it confirms the Standard Model, and everything else that the LHC has done until now has confirmed the Standard Model. The Higgs is a new discovery, but it still confirms the Standard Model, and they want something else that goes beyond that, because the Standard Model, as everyone knows, doesn't describe everything you see in nature. So you want something more. And let's not forget that the LHC... wasn't only built to look for the Higgs, and it wasn't only built with two detectors. There are two other detectors, ALICE and LHCb, which do other stuff, and those detectors are going to be looking, you know, as well as ALICE and CMS. All four of these detectors are going to be looking for other things, as well as refining down what the Higgs is and looking to see if there's anything interesting from that.
I'll just round off this conversation by quoting something that Rolf Dieter Hoyer, who's the Director General of CERN, said about the discovery of the Higgs, or the finding of the signatures of the Higgs. I mean, so when you collide the protons together in the middle of the Large Hadron Collider, you get a spray of particles that decay into all sorts of other things, and it's a real mess down there. And they've got really good at delineating what's what in there using the various mathematical techniques and things. And he said that we can spot the normal collisions. There's billions and billions of those every second. The thing with the Higgs is it's not like finding a needle in a haystack. It's like finding a needle in many haystacks, and all the haystacks are made of needles, and all the needles are slightly different. And so you have to do that many times to then start characterizing it. And it just shows to... It's a real technical tour de force, all of this. And I don't think we can say enough words to go on about how amazing the engineering is and how amazing the physics is. But I think we'll just pause there. We'll probably come back to this subject. We'll move on to something else, which sort of goes along all of science. But let's say the particle physicists are ahead in this area as well, which is open access to government, open access to research. The UK government made its response to some recommendations from the Finch Committee, which published its report a few weeks ago. Ian, you wrote about this. Tell us what they said.
Well, essentially what the government wants to do, and it's in keeping with this report by Dame Janet Finch, an independent report that was commissioned by government to look into open access. This is the idea of making research papers from research funded by the taxpayer openly available once they've been accepted by journals. And this has been bubbling on for more than a decade, this whole idea as to whether, you know, this should happen or not. And this is a significant move that the government has decided that research that is funded by the taxpayer should be available for everybody to see. Essentially, we pay for it, we should be able to see it. But it will also be anyone else in the world. Now, what they're pushing for is mainly something called gold open access, which means that authors pay to have their papers published. And on that condition, the journals make them available online once they've been reviewed and so on. But there's also an element of something called green open access, where the papers can be submitted and reviewed as normal. And then after a period of, say, 6 months, the researchers can put those up online for free themselves. And so that's what the UK policy now is. And research councils will have to find about 1%, 1.5%, something like that, of their budgets, which money which would be used for research now has to go towards publishing papers.
So the Finch report identified that it would cost universities about £50 million a year, at least for the first few years, whilst they have to pay for publication in gold open access, whilst also maintaining subscriptions to journals. Because you would think that if this stuff is available for free, then libraries could reduce their subscriptions to these incredibly expensive journals. But of course, the UK only publishes about 6% of the world's research, so they still need access to, the UK researchers need access to everything else, so they can still have to pay for subscriptions. I mean, the one thing they suggested in the Finch report was perhaps that journals should reduce the fees that they charge to UK researchers, given that some of the stuff that they're getting article processing charges for the rest. This is something still to be worked out. There's the bigger problem, of course, of the US, China, the rest of the world. What are they going to do if they don't ever make their stuff free? Then we'll always have to pay subscriptions as well. I mean, I think that the EU is also moving in this direction. They want their work, anything funded by them, and they're one of the biggest funders of research in the world, billions and billions of dollars, euros rather, every year. And the US and the NIH and everything are sympathetic to this cause. I mean, do you think that, Ian, it's actually, this is something that is just going to happen now, it's inevitable. Publishers just have to get on board with this. I mean, what are the sort of sticking points still?
Well, let's be clear what gold open access is, because the Finch report, as far as I can tell, was asked to look at how you can make research that is funded by the taxpayer open access, open to everybody, without completely screwing the publishing industry. Because if you say, well, all these papers can just go up for free, then the publishers will lose an enormous amount of money and go under. And so will learned societies who in Britain make their money out of selling journals and so on. So this model absolutely supports publishers, because instead of the journal publishers charging libraries a lot of money for their journals, or a little bit amount of money, depending on which publisher you're talking about. But instead of libraries being charged, the authors get charged. So they just change their revenue stream. It doesn't actually change the amount of money that that publishers are going to get. They're charging about £2,000, you know, is ballpark for an article to be published. Now, yeah, so that's where it is.
The argument, I suppose, is that they probably will make less money in the short term, but then they could just publish more. I mean, that's the plus one model, isn't it, to make sure that the stuff is available, open access, but the author pays whatever it is, $1,000, $2,000 for publication, and they just publish lots of lots of articles, and they make money that way. Mm. The Wellcome Trust actually has an interesting angle on this. A few weeks ago, they announced that all of their work, all the work they fund, will also have to be open access, and they're strong proponents of this anyway. And that if researchers who apply for funding from them don't publish in open access journals, then they will either not get parts of their grant, or when they apply again for money, they will be sanctioned, and they'll have to have made all their previous trust-funded work open access. I mean, that's got quite some muscle behind it. I'm not seeing in any of the Research Council's documentation or the government's documentation that if researchers don't do this, if they don't make their stuff open access, that they'll be sanctioned anyway. I mean, it'd be quite hard to police, I'm sure. But you do need that sort of muscle. Otherwise, I mean, even when the Wellcome Trust wanted all of this, all of their work open access, I think only 55% of the papers published ended up open access because scientists either don't have the time or can't be bothered to actually do the administration. Mm. So it's an interesting one to keep going. Just because they all want it to happen doesn't mean it actually will happen.
But there is easily another point here, though. I mean, in that I think you were saying, is this the way it's going? I think inevitably it is going that way, and the government's been doing a lot of things, and the NIH has been pretty successful actually in getting stuff open access. So there's a lot of move, and the European Union has made moves. The day after the UK government came out, the European Union came out and said, we're going to do a very similar thing. So there's a lot of momentum in this direction. But what it still doesn't particularly take into account of, or not wholly take into account of, as far as I can see it, is the fact that the internet may have different ideas, because these models that are being put out there largely still support publishing companies, which is, you can see why that's a sensible thing to do. They make a lot of money, and we get a lot of taxes from them. And they do a valuable job. I'm not arguing that publishers don't do a valuable job. But the internet may just decide, or people may decide through the internet, we don't need that. They may, you know, like physicists using the archive, you write your paper, you put it up for people to see. Those papers then appear in journals usually. But, you know, does that have to happen that way? I think the internet will still change all this.
Okay, thanks very much, Ian. Thanks to Ian Sample. And to discover more about the Higgs or open access, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.